What matters, especially for us as user experience and product people, isn't the effect that the work has on our own lives, it's the effect that it has on the users' lives.
Welcome to the User Defenders Podcast, where we interview successful UX designers who fight for the user in order to inspire and equip you to do the same. And now, here's your host, Jason Ogle.
Greetings, User Defenders. Welcome to episode 18. Today I had the privilege of talking with Adobe Typekit product manager and author David Demery. In addition to his great work on all of our favorite font managers, he has a place in my heart as a fellow coffee snob. We geeked out a little bit on that, so be prepared. Just a fun and enlightening conversation with David Demery that we'll teleport to right now. David Demery is a software maker, speaker, and blogger. He's the author of newly released, a book apart published, Git for Humans. He's a product manager, designer, and web developer for everyone's favorite groundbreaking font service software, Adobe Typekit. He's one of the lucky ones who can say he works really close to a great coffee place called his kitchen. David, I love that. I'm a coffee snob, so I just want to say I'm super excited to have you on User Defenders today.
Awesome. It's wonderful to be here.
Very cool. So every superhero has a secret identity and origin story. Let's talk about yours. I'd like to start the show by you taking a few moments to give us a look into your personal life.
Sure. Well, I'm kind of starting from my origin story. I'm originally from Alabama, and I went to a fine arts high school mainly for painting. And we always had a computer around the house. I think we started out with like an Apple II, then some kind of Apple II clone that they sold at Sears. I don't remember the brand name. And then a succession of like PCs and stuff. So we always had computers around. I never really got into programming them, though. I wasn't one of those people that got into programming when they were 5 years old doing BASIC or even HyperCard and stuff. It's sort of that stuff was always around, but I was playing video games. I'm really into like writing and graphics programs, so like desktop publishing from very early on, and just stuck with that as I was doing creative writing and, you know, normal academic stuff, and certainly with painting and stuff. I went to school for mainly for film and video. So I've in the visual realm, I feel like I've studied just about everything except graphic design, but I've always been sort of graphic design and technology adjacent. I went to college at the School of the Art Institute in Chicago, you know, always kind of found that like the while I was doing art endeavors for school, one of the easier ways for me to find some to make some extra money would be to do some work with computers. So like my student job, like work study job, was doing IT setup work in the school computer lab. And I worked a bit on in high school and in college, worked a bit on the newspaper. And when it came time to find a job right out of school, found a small web design agency that was hiring contractors. And that basically, from then on, I have never not worked near the web.
Awesome. So you've got quite an extensive background, very related areas of interest as well. So I think that's neat that where you are now is, I think, a reflection of all those things you just mentioned. So
yeah,
that's awesome. Tell us your origin story. You kind of did a little bit, but I want to know, I'm really curious, what inspired you to pursue a career in this exciting, challenging, and ever-evolving field?
I think that's a really good question. I think other than just what I said earlier about just having always been around technology and always been around stuff, like we had an internet account, like a dial-up ISP account, about as early as you could have one. I think we got on the internet in like 95. And once the web became a thing, like, you know, like so many people, we started out with AOL. And so all the content we consumed was AOL keywords. But then the web came in and we switched from like the AOL version of the web to the real version of the web in Netscape. And one day I got curious, like, what are these web pages made of? How could I make one of these? Is that something where I need to have like expensive software? Do I need to be part of a big company? And it turns out they're just made of text. And all of your images are just you know, URLs that you reference, and your other pages and all your interactivity is also just you have documents in a folder somewhere and you jump between them using hyperlinks. I thought this was really, really cool. So first I taught myself, there was this thing, I think it was called Web Spinner. I don't know. It was some GUI web authoring application that AOL was distributing. It couldn't do centered text. It couldn't do fonts. It couldn't do anything. It was really, from today's perspective, we'd probably really be into it, sort of like a markdown editor. Like it can only do the basic document markup stuff of HTML. And at the time it was horribly limiting. So I was like, screw this. I'm going to learn how to, cause I had just switched from AOL to Netscape and saw that there were these web pages with tables and blinking text and occasionally different font colors. So I just kept diving into the mechanics of how web pages were put together. And self-taught myself little bits. Anytime I saw a new technique, and this will probably be very familiar to lots of people, I would view source and see how that was put together, and just progressively learn how the web was made throughout high school and into college.
Yeah, it's funny. Your origin story is very parallel to mine. I started also on AOL, and I think that app was, I guess it was an application within their platform, was called Personal Publisher, I think.
Yeah,
that was the one. That's where I started as well. And I couldn't believe that I could create something and also program it and share it with the entire world. I was hooked immediately. And then I also, just made the switch to Netscape, and blinking text was so awesome back then.
Yeah, totally.
That's great. Thanks for sharing that, David. Who has been the biggest superhero in your work and why?
I would say probably my Jeff Veen, and which is kind of another part of my reason. I'm trying to figure out how to set this up. It's an odd thing, because I think he still was one of the early superheroes, especially for his role in designing some of the first really artistically ambitious websites at Wired Digital, like Hotwired, WebMonkey. Those were all things that I followed and used religiously. And then years later, I got to work for Jeff at Typekit. And I remember when I did my interview with him for my current job 5 years ago, I talked to him for probably about 45 minutes, an hour on the phone, came home and said to my then fiance, now wife, well, if this job thing doesn't work out, at least I got to talk to Jeff Veen for 45 minutes. That's pretty cool.
That's awesome. Huge respect for Jeff Veen myself. So I totally appreciate that answer. I respect his work greatly, and I've learned so much from him at the conferences that I've heard him speak at. So truly awesome, awesome choice. And in fact, he was a big part of where you're working now, right? On the Typekit app.
Yeah, he was one of our founders. Typekit was started, it was started as a company called Small Batch. Hmm. And this was like a year or two before, actually more like 2.5 years before I joined. And it was Jeff Veen, Brian Mason, who's now at Visco, Ryan Carver, yeah. and Greg Veen, who I still work with, who's my boss at Adobe today. And those guys started this company, Small Batch. And the main thing that they knew is they wanted to work together. They had some ideas, but they didn't really have a product yet, which is, I think, how like Instagram and a few other startups started, where they, you know, some folks who want to work together and they figure out what they're going to do as they do it. And a couple years in, I think in response to a John Alsop article about web font support coming to browsers, Jeff and the guys saw a market opportunity where, you know, a lot of people then as now are kind of newbies to font licensing, and especially on the web, foundries were newbies to font licensing, where the technology was there where you could put fonts on the web, but a lot of people didn't know all the stuff that you needed to do in terms of acquiring the right licenses and permission, finding a foundry who would make the fonts available, and then hosting the fonts in a way that they worked across a lot of browsers. It's something that you know, once you've got the basic patterns, you kind of know how to do it. And it's a really great place for a hosted service. And no one was doing that yet. And I think John, even in his original blog post, even said this would be a really great opportunity for someone to do a service that just abstracts all of this stuff away. And Jeff was like, we could build such a service. So that's exactly what they did. And they got Jason Santa Maria to work on the user interface. They hired folks like Tim Brown and Ivan Betker to build out the catalog. A really great engineering team, including I don't know why they hired me, but I was one of the late engineering hires for Typekit. And, you know, kind of the rest is history. It launched, a lot of people started using it. We're kind of, I think we're even now still pretty synonymous with web fonts for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And now we're at Adobe, where we have this opportunity to reach a humongous audience.
Yeah, absolutely. Just an incredible product. Truly groundbreaking, revolutionary, still is. The first one to really break through that market and to offer quality stuff too. So I'm a big fan of Typekit. So thank you for all you do over there, David, and all you've done.
Oh, thank you. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely. So this is still kind of a personal question, but kind of a fun one. If you weren't doing this for a living, David, what would be your second career choice and why?
I have really never had a solid idea for what my other career choice would be. It would be something like running a nice coffee shop or like a craft cocktail bar. Although what I worry about is, and I read a thing not too long ago with a woman who had been really into ultra running, you know, extreme marathons, the ones that are like run for 24 hours straight, where there's both an endurance challenge. It's like it's a challenging race, and then there's a whole endurance aspect on top of it. And she'd been doing that as her leisure activity, and then had started blogging about it, and then the blog started to take off and become a business. And what she found was that everything about it that had been fun stopped being fun because it had become her job. Like over time, because her whole relationship to this activity became about like things that would get a lot of engagement on the blog, things that would attract advertisers, and just really totally change the context of it. So I don't know. In a flip side way, sometimes it's actually kind of nice that I've moved into product management, because a lot of the stuff I used to do as a hobby with the web, like coding a website, making even like little throwaway products, is something I can now do again in my spare time as a hobby, because I don't do any coding or actual product making as part of my job. I'm more at the higher level, like conceptually and working on business strategy. So I get a chance to just go back to doing all this stuff just as a hobby, which is great. But that's still to say, like, I don't have a really strong idea for what I would do for a living other than the web. This has been part of my life for so long. I'm pretty sure that I'm a lifer.
Yeah, you're all in, and I appreciate that. So I have to talk about coffee for a second, because I love coffee. I started roasting coffee at home actually a couple years ago.
Nice.
Best choice I've ever made, because I was doing a cost analysis of how much we actually spend buying coffee versus how much it would cost us to just roast it at home. I've never had fresher, more consistently fresh coffee before. But anyway, what's your favorite brew method, David?
I have a few different ones. I mean, I feel bad because we have like my wife's family will come over, and we have this thing that I got on Kickstarter called the Pour Lab, which is a V60 pour over setup where there's two glass cones on a metal tube attached to a cedar wood or walnut base.
Ooh.
And so you can do two cups at the same time, and I use them both every morning because my wife drinks half calf and I drink full calf.
Brilliant.
So I make two different, and we've like two different strengths, so that's really good for that. But I also have an AeroPress that I really like.
Mm-hmm.
I have much love for the Chemex.
Yes.
I think the thing, reason why I mentioned my wife's family coming over is they're always a little intimidated by our setup, because I do it in this very fussy barista way where I have a scale. I try to get the freshest beans that I can. I have an opinion about whether I'm drinking the Kenya or the Guatemala today.
Yeah.
And really what I found is if you want to have a really good, satisfying cup of coffee, like what you're doing with the home roasting and the freshness, like getting really good beans as fresh as you can get them is like the number one determining factor. And then just brew them a cup at a time. And it doesn't, I guess if I would have a slight preference for the pour over, because I think it makes a richer cup, but it isn't totally like sludge sometimes that you get.
Yeah.
Like sludge makes it sound awful. Like there are some coffees from a French press that are just delightful and delicious and wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they have to be only certain kinds of coffees, like an Arabian or an Indonesian one, to kind of stand up to that. Because if you like put Colombian coffee through that, you're just going to taste the grind. You're going to taste the grinds, basically.
Yep, absolutely. I agreed. I love all those methods as well. I actually haven't done the V60 yet. I think that's the next one. But love the Chemex lately. Just the most clean cup I've had. And I had our DirecTV guy was over, and I offered him a cup, and he was watching me nerd out. And I got the digital scale, the IKEA scale that connects to my phone. And he's like, you know, there's
that's
a
nice.
Yeah, that's awesome. He's like, you know, there's a support group for people like you.
Yeah, I mean, right now, I think if I had to commit myself to one answer, V60 is what I use every day. But right now, at the Adobe offices, we have these coffee robots where they have it like will grind the beans, make a fresh single cup of coffee. You just do everything on a touch screen, which is probably like an Android tablet or something bolted to this coffee robot. The coffee is not fantastic by like coffee nerd standards, but you know, for office coffee, it's pretty solid.
Oh, awesome. So, that's great. You got a huge leg up on a lot of other offices, I can tell you that much.
Yeah. It's like the man said, the best coffee is the one you have with you.
There it is. Awesome. Thanks for indulging me on that. I wanted to extract some of that from you. Pardon the pun. I wanted to extract some of that from you. Let's talk about your life-altering experiences and get into your transformation, David. Every superhero has some sort of life-altering experience that helps guide their purpose and leads to a transformation where they realize the powers they have and they harness them for the greater good. Certainly a significant among those is failure. Failure is not something we like to talk about or certainly not put on our LinkedIn page, but it's unquestionably one of life's greatest teachers. Can you tell us a story about what's been the biggest one in your career?
I'm trying to think of it because I can't think of too many that have been just like clear. The thing about a lot of failures, especially in this line of work, is sometimes failure is on a continuum where either it's something that seems like a failure only in retrospect or it's like incrementally a failure. I could say that in my whole career, spanning even like college and stuff, one of the just the most embarrassing moments was way, way back in film school. I had done an edit, or actually almost a non-edit. I had like a 60-minute source tape of where I'd gone out with a bunch of friends to film them doing a performance art with a bonfire by Lake Michigan, something really, really pretentious. And I caught the whole thing mostly on black and white digital video, because I was that kind of person. And I brought this into my digital video editing class with an actual filmmaker teaching it, and showed it and was waiting to, you know, hear everyone's praise. And got a you know, it's art school, so people are very hesitant to just say this sucks. They want to be like, it's interesting. I think this raised some interesting points, but it could have been better in this area. And the professor was just having none of it. He was like, why would I watch this? Why did you make me spend 45 minutes watching this? And you know, so I was like, why are you being mean to me? But then he was also like kind of making the point, which is like, it was not effective at its length. And maybe I should consider cutting it like more than in half. Like he wanted to see a 10-minute version of a 45-minute film. And I was like, I can't imagine ever doing this at 10 minutes. This is an insane request. You're basically trying to sabotage me. So then I calmed down, probably had a cup of coffee and then calmed down. And then thought about it. I was like, well, you know, I have failed to win him over. What I need to do is just try the 10-minute version. And then the superiority of my ideas will be evident and I'll turn this failure into a victory. And what ended up happening is I liked the 10-minute version way, way better. And I learned a ton about the value of simplicity and brevity and really just editing. Like I learned that like, oh, this is actually what editing is. I can take all of the ideas and images that I thought were important and emphasize those and draw the viewer's attention to those. And be like, this is the 10-minute highlight reel and it's better.
Yeah, That's a tough one because anytime we create, we put our hearts on our sleeves, and we're always opening ourselves up to criticism, especially the larger our platform is. So that's challenging. But I wanted to ask you, David, what do you want our listeners to take away from that lesson?
I think just again the importance of editing. Let me restart that thought.
Sure.
I mean, the value of editing certainly and of simplicity, but also the value of not getting too wrapped up in one's own, I guess, closeness to the material, or not taking a criticism of the work as a personal criticism, because I think that's something that a lot of people struggle with. I know I still do sometimes, where you get really attached to the idea of something. You really want it to succeed, and you get your own ego wrapped up into it. But, you know, if you look at it from someone else's perspective, it may not have the same effect. And what matters, especially for us as user experience and product people, isn't the effect that the work has on our own lives. It's the effect that it has on the user's lives and how the effect that you have in someone else's head. And so being able to empathize with that and gracefully deal with it if it turns out that your supposition about what the work is doing, if you find out that you're wrong, they'll be like, okay, that's interesting. I want to hear how someone else saw it and then figure out, you know, certainly, you know, we don't want to just become completely numb to our own wishes. I mean, there's, you know, there are things that as people who make software and make creative work that we want to be engaged and excited by what we're doing. But I think there's always a way to find something that's exciting to you that also speaks to other people. And that's really where a lot of the magic happens, is finding a way to connect with people through the work.
Absolutely. David, do you have a story of something really crazy or super awkward that happened during user testing?
I've been thinking about this a lot because I've not had the pleasure of doing any kind of organized user testing, I'm sorry to say.
That's all right.
I think one experience that's just been kind of awkward just in introducing people to software for the first time, which is not software that I had like designed, but maybe more like a project management system I was adopting, is back in the early days when Basecamp had first launched. I was going to try to use it to start, I don't remember what it was, if we were planning like a trip or a web journal, but with my friend Mary, I sent her access to a shared to-do list on Basecamp. And to this day, I'm not actually sure if it was just that I hadn't quite explained how it had worked or something, but she loaded it with a lot of her personal grocery listed stuff. And I got disproportionately upset. I was like, how is it not obvious that this is a shared to-do list for our personal, for this thing that we're planning? And then later realized, oh wait, it was completely not obvious. How could she possibly have known that this is what we're doing if I didn't explain it? And, you know, I think that kind of thing happens a lot in user testing situations. I've had little, like, I'm really struggling to think of a specific thing, but there's always little places where, if you're testing out a product for the first time, you find out that bits of it are not coming across the way that you intended, and you have to like explain a little bit more clearly. I have a little iOS app that I shipped just as a side project a few years ago, and I will still get occasional support email about it. Things like the passcode lock feature is not intuitive enough, or people don't know how to delete something. And so it's like an ongoing lesson in the some of my failings as a UI designer like 5 years ago, because software is still kicking around.
Absolutely, and I looked into that a little bit. I think that's wonderful too. I think it was something you and your wife were talking about, gift box. I think is what it was called.
Yeah, gift box.
Yes.
I can't remember if I even still have it listed as something you can download. I can't remember if I took it down or if I made it.
I don't know if it is. I don't know if it is, but I was just kind of looking into it. I think that's awesome that you did that. It's a really good lesson to all of us about scratching your own itch and building something. Just building something, solving a problem. I think that's I'm glad you mentioned that, because I think that's a really cool thing that you did there. And whether or not it had this, you know, lifelong longevity thing, it was something that you were able to build, and you were able to solve a problem that you saw a need for. And I think that's the lesson right there.
Yeah, definitely. And I certainly learned a lot making it. I actually still from time to time will have ideas for like a version 3 and be like, oh, I'd really love to do version 3 this year. Maybe if I get out enough ahead of Christmas, I'll have time to do it. And yeah. I have a toddler and I'm a product manager on an Adobe product. I will never have time to work on that again.
Yep. There you go. And that's one of the, it's the beauty and the curses of this industry.
Yeah.
Totally. And life in general, right? I totally identify. I've got a lot of kids. I've got seven, number seven on the way. So completely cool. Identify. Yeah. So David, what's your design superpower?
I think my best superpower is just trying to get to basics and simplify things, at least as a way of understanding them from like down at the bare metal, so that I can, you know, I think a fine example of this is like looking at the type industry and looking at the TypeKit user interface. I think there's a lot of convention that can come into like a searching and sorting user interface, and there's certainly a lot of convention to fonts, to the type industry, to how professional designers are used to working with stuff. So one strategy and you know, other examples of this is like any kind of search interface that you're coming into from some niche in the industry, like digital photo or asset management, like trying to look at how photos should be put together. I find it really helpful to just try to get back to a place of like really, really basic beginner's mind and try to just simplify things to their absolute essence, and then maybe put some of the pieces back together again. So it's like if you're looking at the TypeKit browsing interface, try to think back to like, what are all the pieces of information that are on this page? Not with the like semantic baggage really of fonts, not trying to think like, well, I mean, as a font site, of course, all this information needs to be here, but rather like actually make a list of everything that is there or could be there and think about it just at a really, I keep saying really basic level, but just kind of put the components back together in different configurations and think, well, you know, is everything here actually doing a job? Is everything here contributing to the overall effect, or is it some of it just here because we're used to it being here? And a lot of the time, the answer is yes, everything here is doing a purpose. Everything here is fulfilling some role and is important to the user, but it's good to be able to take all the different pieces apart, just figure out, like, take what is the absolute simplest version of something that could exist and ask yourself if it's sufficient, and then maybe add a little bit more back in, and then just start creeping back up to the simplest thing that works without compromising functionality or understandability or the joy of the user.
Absolutely agree, David. I get really bothered by interfaces that are showing me things I don't even need to see, like kind of just in case. I think just in time is the way to approach interface design. And Luke Rubliski talks a lot about that too. Don't give them everything up front. You're gonna scare them away. And so I definitely appreciate that answer. One of my pet peeves too is I loved Ardeo. I loved the service. I was more of a Spotify guy, but I had to use Ardeo here at work. Because of the firewall. But I did start really enjoying that, the simplicity of that. But the thing that bothered me the most about both services is they would show me music that I couldn't listen to.
Right.
Why are you showing me this? If I can't listen to it, if I can't partake of this content, why are you putting it in front of me? So that was always something that bothered me. So that, I think that kind of speaks to just keep it simple and only give the users what they need at the time they need it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, we have a related problem with that, which we are still, you know, it's been a couple years since we launched Desktop Font Sync for TypeKit. And we occasionally will get tweets or emails about the fact that not everything that you see on TypeKit is available for sync. Oh. And that's, you know, really up to that's worked out with us and our Font Foundry partners. Many of them have some fonts that are, you know, really, they have a really robust, I don't want to imply that the fonts that are available for sync aren't also successful products for normal perpetual licensing, but we have some Foundry partners that don't want to participate in sync. We have some that have some fonts that they haven't really wanted to contribute to the sync library just yet. So in our user interface, you're looking at everything, but about 3/4 of it is available only for the web because those are the fonts that you know, our Foundry partners have chosen to make available for the web. Uh-huh. And there are many, many good options that you can use for both web and sync, but we still will get some people who are kind of you know, thrown off by that because they come to TypeKit looking for fonts that they can use everywhere, yeah, and not all of them are available. And it's a really hard information design problem that we struggle with because, yeah, we want to show you as many options as you possibly can and give you the best information about what you can use. But it also has to do with not only the availabilities for the fonts and each individual variation within the font families, but also your own plan. Because if you're on our free level versus the paid level, you might have different sets of options. And be able to deal with all that complexity and still have an easy-to-use interface is a constant challenge.
Wow. Well, I was going to try to suggest something, but I'm sure you've thought of it, and I'm sure you guys, and you kind of spoke to the reason why this might not work, but filtering based on whether the fonts are available on whatever platform. But again, you kind of touched on some of the other complexities involved with user status and things like that. So I know you guys are thinking about it, and I'm sure you'll solve that problem.
I like your confidence.
Got nothing but faith in you. David, adversely, what's your design kryptonite?
Oh, man. Well, I can't draw for sure. No, I'm sorry. I think that the design kryptonite is I have a few. I mean, a shadow superpower of mine, which I think I may lean on too much, and which is also a kryptonite in its own way, is oversimplifying and try to solve problems by just defining them out of existence. And that's kind of, I think, a sign of impatience, where it just, you know, it's always really tempting to go for the easy win, and sometimes you can just say, well, maybe the elegant solution to this problem is to just do nothing, or just, you know, be okay with things as they are. And frequently that is the right approach, but you have to have a really, I think, strong sense of, I guess, the user's needs and, you know, what would happen if you did or didn't do a certain change. So I think that's one thing that can always come back to bite you is the desire to just think of the more elegant word for it, but just to, to just go a little bit too far in, too far both in talking yourself out of doing any work, but also overthinking it. You have to kind of be constantly in touch with whether you are actually solving the problem at the right level, whether you've, you know, overthought it or not thought it too much. And it's really tempting to go for shortcuts. I think that, I guess then the answer to that question is my design kryptonite are some of those shortcuts, like just making things really, really super simple, really solving strongly for one particular use case in the desire to just get on with the next thing.
Gotcha. Yeah. I guess that's a good problem, I would say. There could be certainly way worse kryptonites than that I would speak to. So I think that's a great problem. And I think it's a great case for user testing as well.
Yeah, it absolutely is. I think it's a superpower in the same way of like the thing in The Lord of the Rings where Cate Blanchett is, takes the ring and then turns to a monster for like 30 seconds.
Yes.
And then it's like, I need to hand this back. This is not the direction I need to go in. She would probably have benefited from user testing.
That is a great analogy, my friend. And this is a good opportunity for me to just share that I've been reading through Git for Humans, and it's a great read. I'm definitely highly recommending it to all of our defenders. But I just love your writing style, David. You aside from your sharp wit, which is the soul of it is brevity, like you said in there, but you have a way with parables, which makes taking complex concepts like Git much more comprehensive and relatable. So I this was an opportunity for me to share that.
Oh, thank you.
Absolutely. So
yeah, the book was kind of a constant challenge of what I was just saying about like trying to simplify just enough or talk about things at the right level, because I've worked with Git for years and I feel like I know it pretty well, even though there are still some parts of it that I'm scared of, and it was a challenge to keep it grounded in what people are going to need to know and not be too hand wavy, but not be too detailed. Because if it's too hand wavy, you're not actually explaining the concept very well. Mm. And if it's too detailed, then people just raise up their hands. They say, I'm out. I'm going back to hating Git.
Yep. No, you struck the balance, my friend. Absolutely. Highly recommend it. Absolutely.
Hi, I'm Rachel Andrew, and you're listening to the User Defenders podcast with Jason Ogle.
So this one's kind of fun, this question here, and I caveat this question with none of us got where we are on our own. We all need people, and you've certainly been able to surround yourself with some great heroes of our work, like Veen and Santa Maria and some of these other guys. And so, but I would ask you, you certainly have achieved a level of success in your career. What would your UX design superhero name be, David?
I was talking about this with my wife last night, and I was overthinking it as I want to do. And as she's wanted to do, she brought it back home and said it should be the Simplifier. Because I was trying to think of superhero names that were a little bit more flashy. about you know, like the reducer or something like that. It's just like, no, you simplify things. You're the simplifier.
Perfect. Wow, your wife is a great helper to you.
She really is.
That's awesome. She had that. That's a great idea. So that, I love that. That's perfect. So David, one of my favorite lines from Tron was when he said, "I fight for the users." How do you fight for your users?
Well, the first really, really important thing always is to try to understand who your users are and where they're coming from. And so, and then be able to kind of, you know, it's important to be able to, you can't, like, if you have like a very diverse user base, as I would say we probably do, because we have a lot of, at Typekit, we have a lot of users who have been with us from the very beginning, who are web designers. As they rely on us to host their fonts, to handle compatibility, to handle licensing, and they want the whole turnkey environment. And then within the broader web community, we have people who are really insistent on certain performance characteristics and want to have more control over individual details of how the fonts perform and are served. You know, we have enterprise customers who bring their own custom licenses and don't need that aspect. And now that we're part of Adobe, we have desktop customers who use integrations within the Adobe products. We have desktop customers who use apps like Sketch that are not made, or Keynote that are not made by Adobe, and so need to get to the fonts that way. So there's a lot. There are probably dozens of different Typekit customer archetypes. So it's important to try to learn as much as you can about who all of those different people are. At the same time, you can't be overwhelmed with details. So you have to make some good decisions around just like, what are a few personas that are credible? They're not like invented fake people that might use your product, but which are drawn from real life evidence about how people do use the product. And then bring those people into the meetings where you're discussing the design of the product and try to think about how they are going to interact with it, or how they're going to get things done, and how their workflows are going to be supported by the work that you're doing. A practical thing that I do for that is, because I, you know, as much as I think that I have a very good brain, there's only so much information and detail that you can keep in your head when you're also dealing with all the details of designing software. So I try to make sure that our customer support team, Liz Golly, Ben Welch, and Molly Doan, that one or all of them is present at meetings where we're trying to figure out a thorny design problem, so that they can look at it from the customer perspective and through the lens of all the emails and tweets that they deal with every day. So that, you know, it's a little bit like I fight for the users by having someone else fight for the users, but it's a little bit like I try whenever possible to make sure that the people who have the most contact with customers are in the room where decisions are being made, so that we aren't going to lose sight of anyone's particular needs.
I love that. Bring the users along with you throughout the process, because they're totally the ones that you're fighting for, right? And involve them with that. I think that's just totally the way to go, and truly user-centered design right there. So, David, this is one of my favorite questions, but it's a biggie. It's all about the future, and I was curious, what do you think the future of UX looks like?
This is a really good and hard question, especially because if you'd asked me like 5 years ago when I started this job what the future looked like, I probably would have said iPad all the time. And I think, I'm talking to you on an iPad, so I was right in that regard.
Nice.
But I don't know if anyone would have predicted watches, smart TVs, or any of that stuff. So I think we have lots of new affordances in user experience. We've gone from like having smartphones that didn't do a ton at that time relative to what they can do right now, to having our data and our apps on all of these different devices, having a whole range of screens from really, really tiny to like 72-inch smart TVs, and some of the same apps run on all of them. You have the same data available on all of them. So there's a whole continuum of experience. And I think the future of UX, first of all, is leveraging all of that. And that's but hardly even the future. That's really what the present is, figuring out how to reach people with the interactions where they want to be reached, and be able to, you know, give people little quick wins throughout the day with their data and with your app, wherever it's appropriate on all these devices. I think the next step beyond that, though, is figuring out how to pull that back and make all of these small interactions smarter so that they don't become overwhelming. Like I was thinking earlier about like notifications. it's really tempting to try to, because one of the things that we can do now with notifications, with proactive assistance like the Siri and Google Now, is we don't need to wait for a user to come and ask to have an experience. We can reach into their daily lives with bits of user experience. We can give them notifications that even ask a question, like we say, a thing happened, would you like to perform one of these three actions? And they can interact with the service just in very tiny things from the lock screen of their phone. We can wait for them to like literally ask a question with their voice and then exchange data that way. But all of these things are encroaching more and more on people's daily lives. And that's, I think, one reason why the Apple Watch has a bit of a, I mean, the Apple Watch is not a flawless product, but I think one of the things that has made it hard for people to get into is it doesn't have a strong opinion over how much is too much in order to get to the comfortable level of intrusiveness into your life. You have to go into the settings a lot and say, all right, this is a notification I don't need on my wrist. This is an interaction or an app that I don't need. This app doesn't perform well on the wrist, so I'm not going to deal with it. You have to have a lot of agency to decide how much you're going to interact with that. So it's very tempting to just take the thing off, throw it in a drawer, and go get a nice quartz watch instead. So I think the next stage of user experience is figuring out how to do all of this stuff in a way that is more valuable to the user, so that we have this whole continuum of experience. Like if the easiest way for me to respond to a Slack notification is on my wrist, that is a genuine benefit in my life. But there needs to be some guidance as to what's important enough to interrupt dinner without having to turn off every possible interaction so that I'm not interrupted.
Wow. I'm not even going to try to add to that because I thought that was an awesome answer. But I was thinking too about when you were talking about some of these Internet of Things and that just kind of where we're heading and where we actually already are, as you mentioned right now. I think one of the biggest challenges we have as designers are creating patterns that make sense for people, because I had Golden Krishna on episode 11, I think it was, and he wrote a really great book called The Best Interface is No Interface, and he touches on things like that, like our the car door app. So he outlined there's probably 15 steps to use your phone to unlock your car door when all you really need to do is just grab your key. So I think that's kind of one of those challenges for designers is if we are going to put the internet on everything and, you know, beaconing and NFC, all this stuff, I think we need to really create patterns that make sense for people. Otherwise, it's never going to really fly.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a principle of robustness that you're going to use to with things that the Internet of Things is still catching up with. I mean, I even have this a little bit with like with Apple Pay. Like this morning on the way onto the train into the city, I got a coffee and a scone at the coffee shop in my town in New Jersey, and they had just gotten the Apple Pay Square readers. So I had to like stop the line for a few minutes because I wanted to use Apple Pay. And it wasn't, not a few minutes actually, it was probably more like 45 seconds, but
because probably felt like a few minutes.
It probably felt like a few minutes, especially for the people behind me in line.
Yeah.
Because they were using Square and they had the little Square Apple Pay reader, and it was probably the smoothest possible experience, except it was the first time that the person checking me out had ever used Apple Pay as a cashier. So we had the 45 seconds, which is, how does this work? You know, all of these things can be seamless, but let me think how to rephrase it. It's like, you know, it's really great to have a smart car door lock that you can unlock with your phone or your watch, but the most important thing is that it behave like a car door lock, or that, you know, your front door that has a Bluetooth thing that you can use to unlock it to let people in. If you can't get into your house when it's 10 degrees out because your phone is acting up, then that's a failure of technology. So it's like, first be a good door lock and then figure out how to use technology to add a layer of magic to it. The layer of magic is really exciting, but if it causes the thing to break, then it doesn't matter. You're standing outside and it's 10 degrees and your baby's screaming at you and your life is a failure at that moment.
Absolutely, man. This episode is brought to you by Universal Mind, a digital design and consulting company based in Denver, Colorado. Whether you started as a digital company or not, we're all digital now, and that's been a tough transition for many organizations. Universal Mind helps mid to enterprise-sized companies find and deliver something valuable through design thinking workshops, UX design, and development consulting, and believes in supporting user defenders to help train and inspire the next generation of designers. Learn more at universalmind.com. So let's wrap up the show with imparting of superpowers. David, what's one habit that you believe contributes to your success?
I think that probably curiosity and persistence, and they go hand in hand in a way that can be, not always the most pleasant for other people, which really to say, like, you know, I try to Slack makes this quite easy, which is to just try and keep my, I'm curious about everything that's going on. I try to dig in a little bit to every topic that comes across my radar and feed that into a grand unified theory of where our business is at, what our users are doing, and just go out and get whatever intelligence I can about where things need to go. And, I tend to do that in a lot of different areas of life. Like, you know, we were talking about coffee for what felt like 20 minutes. the way that happened is I worked at Starbucks for 3 years during the tail end and out of college. Hmm. And I had never been exposed to like whole bean coffee as a thing that happened, or, you know, as a thing that, people drank. So like once I got a little taste of that, I then started like buying books about it, doing tons of internet research, finding out all the different brewing methods and just becoming an autodidact about coffee. And then, you know, brought that back to work and was able to make recommendations of the different coffee beans, sort of, you know, going to an absurd degree, beyond where, maybe the job called for. And, you know, that's a pattern I think that has helped me out quite a bit, even though it can be kind of intense in the moment, because I, you know, if I find something that's interesting, I want to learn everything about it and then figure out how that connects to other things in life or in business. And, you know, sometimes really cool stuff comes out of those inferences.
Love it. David, what's your most invincible UX resource or tool you can recommend to our listeners?
No
worries.
Most invincible resource or tool. Honestly, I follow a lot of people who do UX work, like product, user experience, research, design. I follow a lot of people on Twitter and, whatever the social network, but primarily Twitter, and see the links that they post. A lot of my Twitter graph kind of feeds into Medium, so I get recommended a lot of stuff about design and user experience, but really just staying in touch with the community and following people that I respect and seeing what they're reading, seeing what they're talking about, and then digging in when something catches my eye as an interesting resource. I hesitate to say a book apart because I have a book on a book apart and I would like for people to buy my book apart, but all the other books in that series are really fantastic. And some of them, especially Josh Clark's new book about designing for touch, Aaron Walter's book about designing with emotion, all the stuff about content strategy from Aaron Kassane and Karen McGrain. Those are really excellent books. The most persistent thing is just, you know, when someone, especially if you like see the same link pop up more than once or twice in the feed of people that you follow, definitely read that and, read as much as you can.
That's awesome. Definitely keep a pulse on the community. And I've also benefited so much from Twitter and people sharing things and being generous, that's one thing that I love about this community. There's so much generosity and so much helping hand out there. So love that answer. So in addition to Git for Humans, which I highly recommend, could you recommend one book to our listeners? What would that be and why? You already recommended a couple.
Yeah, I already recommended a couple. Yeah. Let's see if I've got one more. Yeah. I think one book that I have actually mentioned to people a few times recently is a book called The Idea Factory, which is about the history of Bell Labs going way back from like before World War II in like the 30s. I'm probably going to do one of those things where I don't actually know what I'm talking about. I think like the late 20s and 30s when Mervyn Kelly first started Bell Labs, and then going all the way through, I think, even until like the 60s and 70s when Unix was being developed, and certainly all the key moments in between. And because they had such a long history of sustained invention and innovation, and there's a lot of discussion of not only how they came to some of the research inventions like information theory and the original research that led to the transistor, but also how those things were brought to market And I find it it's a really interesting book, and I think just a kind of a fascinating read into how research and business are intertwined and how they can complement each other.
I love how your mind works, man. Keep writing, keep sharing, because you got a lot of great stuff happening in there and a lot to offer. So that's great.
Thanks, man.
Absolutely. So this is my last question for this section here, and it's we're about to wrap up here, David. So I appreciate you got a couple more minutes.
Absolutely.
Okay, awesome. So, David, this is also one of my favorite questions, because this show is all about, again, we talked about the community. This is sort of my effort to give back after having done this for a number of years and not doing much in that way. So this question is one of my favorites, and it's what's your best advice for aspiring UX design superheroes?
Well, I think other than what I said about, following some people, it's almost like, you want to find and follow some virtual mentors, people whose careers you want to track or whose work is interesting. I mean, following someone, at least for a little while on Twitter or something, or just reading their whole back catalog of tweets and links and articles is a pretty cheap way to get a peek into someone's mind. I think other than that, though, is just practice. Like, yes. A lot of the stuff that I did early on, like I'm not a particularly accomplished web or graphic designer, but I think I definitely got my 10,000 hours in of how web software is built. In addition to just like how web pages are made, I also was worked early on with like Ruby on Rails. I taught myself PHP, so that kind of insatiable curiosity just led me down all different paths of how software is made. So I'm not necessarily recommending that people like spend a bunch of time learning to code, because I guess what I'm actually saying is definitely take the time to try things out that are interesting. It isn't that important if it leads to any particular project being successful, but you'll definitely learn something just in trying to apply yourself to new things.
Oh, it's so good. Just build something. You'll never know and you'll never learn unless you try, unless you just practice that and build it. So great advice.
Yeah, absolutely.
Awesome. Well, as we close, David, can you tell us about the one thing you're working on that you're most excited about?
Many of the things that I am working on, I cannot talk about.
Okay.
It's very sad for me.
I understand.
I'm trying to think of what things, other than just the stuff that I'm working on at Typekit, I think what I can say about it is we are working and thinking really hard about where the product is going to go in the future. And we had a really exciting year last year. I know that one of the things that people ask for a lot is just expanding our font catalog. And last year we expanded into Japanese web fonts for the first time. Mm. We launched first a Japanese browsing interface and the ability to do dynamic web font serving in Japanese, which is a first for a Western company. And then later in the year, we had a partnership with the biggest type foundry over there. So things like that, where we try to go into entirely new markets, and just that's the kind of thing that we're interested in, not to say that we're working on anything specific. Think of how we can, partner with new type foundries and just make the whole service easier to use. We're going to just keep rocking and rolling and ship things for our users.
Awesome. Selfishly, what's your next thing you're working on in coffee?
Oh, man. Sometimes I feel like I need a break from the coffee. I need a break from the coffee grind. See, there's a pun for you.
There you go.
I just restarted my, cause I had been like going all around trying to find like the best, like, New Yorkers, just always want the best of everything. Like, this is the best bagel shop. This is the best pizza in town.
Yeah.
And I've been going all around trying to find like the best, New York area coffee roaster. And I finally just like declared bankruptcy on that and restarted my Blue Bottle subscription because I just wanted fresh, good coffee that is so easy to get. It's already in my mailbox.
Mm. Blue Bottle it's really hard to beat, that coffee.
Yeah.
Quality.
It's really good stuff.
Absolutely. Thanks for that. So as we close again, why don't you tell our audience the best way to connect and to keep up with you, David?
Probably my Twitter, certainly. I'm in the middle of redoing my website, which actually at the moment I've taken all style sheets off of it because I just wanted to make sure the information was up to date. So I took the whole thing down, and there was just a like completely vanilla 1995 era web page set in whatever your browser's default font is at demery.me. And linked from there is my Twitter, Typekit, there's a link to my book. And I've also put some longer stuff up on Medium recently. Mostly like a series of articles where I compare things to Beats headphones, which is one of my new bad habits. But that's the best place to look for all things Demery.
Cool. So if we visit your website right now, will we see tables with border equals 10, cell padding equals 10?
No, but that's an excellent idea.
Please.
As soon as we get off Skype, I'm going to make that change.
Can you make that happen?
I can make that happen.
And maybe a blinking marquee text on the hero. We need to try to figure out a way to go old school without annoying people.
I don't know if there's a thing that's going on the internet where there's like an Easter egg in the Amazon Web Services Terms of Service, and I won't say what it is, so people can go and look for it.
Nice.
I think that probably someone should try to slip an Easter egg into the HTML5 specification that makes Blink official. Like we're coming up on, or we just went past like the 20th anniversary, or I think this year is going to be probably the 20th anniversary of the HTML tag specification, or like HTML2 or something. That would be a good anniversary present for the web, I think.
Absolutely. I love it. And here's an April Fool's idea for the W3C. Maybe they can make Blink an actual specification.
Yeah.
There we go, right?
And probably Blink would be the first engine to implement it. So you have Blink on Blink.
Boom. All right. Hope you're listening, guys. Go for it. You heard it here first. All right. Well, David, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for being here today. It's been an awesome pleasure chatting with you. I learned a lot. And again, recommend your book. Everyone, Defenders, go and buy that. You'll learn so much. This is the way to build websites now. You have to know this stuff. And David makes it really easy to do so in his book, Git for Humans, by A Book Apart. So I just want to say fight on, my friend.
Awesome. Thanks very much for having me.
That was a lot of fun. I found David to be such an enlightening, smart guy who's got a lot to offer. And I'm glad he's writing, as I mentioned. I'm glad he's blogging. And so just a lot to learn from him and his experience in this medium we all love so much. Now, as mentioned, David is the author of newly released Git for Humans. He takes a complex topic like Git and makes it much easier for us mere mortals to understand. For anybody building websites with others, this is the de facto way to do that now. So really important and valuable to understand Git. Now, our great friends at A Book Apart are offering 15% off his new book using coupon code GITHERO. I'll be sure to put a link and the code in the show notes. Definitely take advantage of this soon, Defenders. This great offer is only valid through April 30th. If you're enjoying the show, I'd leap over tall buildings if you'd take a minute to leave a rating and review on iTunes by visiting userdefenders.com/review. Or if you're on your phone, there's a link in the show notes that will teleport you right to it. I want to thank Cesar Limas for the astonishing superhero artwork, Chris Combs for the superhuman editing, and Wyman Gentry for the compelling show music. Thanks again so much for listening, and until next time, fight on, my friends.